So welcome back to Fresh from the Hill, the C-List series. Today we'll be talking about the Day Hall Takeover, which I think in our conversation we'll talk a little bit how that name is not as crazy and serious as it may appear. My guest today, Keddie Esquivel, who you heard about on our first episode, but I'll give her a brief moment to just give a summary and highlight of herself.
Oh, thanks, Joseph. So nice to be on the podcast with you again today. So again, my name is Keddie Esquivel. I'm the vice president for CELA, the Cornell Latino Alumni Association, and really excited to chat with you a little bit about the Day Hall Takeover today. I am an author, and I am currently working on a couple of books, and one of those books is actually about the Day Hall Takeover. And so I'm really excited to have that conversation with you today, Joseph.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Keddie. And I know you're fighting a little cold, a little sickness, so really appreciate you again for hopping on this call. So let's start at the beginning. You know, you were as a freshman part of the takeover, but let's talk about a little bit before that. How was it arriving to campus? How was dorm life? And what school were you in?
Yeah, so I arrived to campus in the summer of 1993, and I was 17 years old, so a baby freshman. And I came to campus right before the freshman year started as a part of what was called at the time COSUP, COSUP Summer. And so that was a program for folks that historically were not as represented at the university. And so, you know, you had folks that were from different communities of color, African-American, as well as folks that were considered themselves Latino, Latina, and also folks from places in New York that historically didn't attend the university. And that's because Cornell, as you know, is both a private school and a statutory school. So it's also part of the state system of New York State. And so I arrived that summer of 1993 as a 17-year-old, and my first dormitory was actually Ujamaa, because all of us dormed at Uj together. That was where we all stayed for the summer, and it was an extraordinary experience. You know, I was surrounded by folks that were very curious about this Cornell experience, but in many cases didn't have as much familiarity with the area as I did. I'm originally from upstate New York, as you might recall from our first podcast. And so for me, going to Cornell, going to Ithaca, it was just 2 hours from my home in Rochester, New York. And so you know, where I was with a community of folks that were people of color like me, and, you know, several of the people spoke Spanish like I did. That was my first language. I actually didn't speak English until going to school. That Spanish was my first language in the home. And so even though, you know, there was kind of that affinity with similarities in that way, I was distinct insofar as I was really the only person that was from the area. So Ithaca very much felt like home to me, and it was wonderful to get a chance to share that with a community that was on campus during that COSUP summer. After that COSUP summer, I then, you know, went back home to Rochester, New York, 2 hours north for a little bit, and then came back down to Ithaca to start the school year. And the school that I was in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, but I took to heart the idea of any person, any study. And I really tried to take classes across all of the different schools at Cornell. In fact, I did take classes at each and every one of the schools at Cornell, except for engineering. I just, you know, it was an extraordinary experience. And I, as an ILRE, I really was grateful for the opportunity to look into issues of history and social movements. And I actually went because at the time I was thinking of becoming a lawyer. My father had worked in the court system here in upstate New York, and I thought that that would be of interest to me. And so that's why I was an ILRE. And for my dorm life, my freshman year, I started as someone who lived in the dorm Risley. So Risley Residential College is actually the Performance Art Storm of Cornell. And I'm someone that has always been artistic. So I play the piano. I played it since I was 4 years old. I sing, I draw, I write, I perform. I've done acting. And so I loved Risley. It was such an extraordinary experience that I actually decided to stay beyond my freshman year. So I lived several years in Risley because it gave me that balance to the academic rigor that I found at Cornell. I had that creative outlet in that dorm. The only time that I ventured away from there was when I was within water margin for a stint, and then also lived off campus for a bit. But besides that, was mostly at Risley.
Awesome. Thank you so much for providing that background and providing kind of that context in terms of where is that community for Latino and Latine students at the time. Can you talk about the Revelaciones Revelations exhibit? How did it come to your attention and what were your thoughts of it?
Sure. So as I had shared earlier, I had kind of gotten connected with a Latino community at Cornell through my COSEP engagement all the way back in summer of 93 at the age of 17. However, I remained very much still connected with that kind of cohort group of folks who had become really great friends that summer. And many of us were in different organizations together. And so they're still at the time, y'all might know of the organization Sabor Latino, that just does incredible performances and dances. There was at the time something called the Mexican American Student Association, which is now MECHA. And during my tenure too at Cornell, and kind of out of MASA, grew something called Ballet Folklorico Mexicano, which is the traditional Mexican dancing. And it was really beautiful, and it was a privilege to be able to do that and perform that for my family, my father being Mexican. He was really excited to see that. And so through my participation with those organizations, as well as La Asociación Latina, which was really the umbrella organization for all of the different Latino groups on campus, I first kind of started hearing about how folks were feeling about what was happening as it relates to the Revelaciones exhibit. And so, again, I had mentioned it in passing, but I do just want to punctuate the fact that the campus at the time was not representative of the Latino community. We were only 5% of the community at the time in the 90s. And so it was a really huge change when I went from COSEP into the regular school year, because we were so few, so it was very, very much diluted once everyone else came back. So if you imagine, 5%, so we're talking 5 out of every 100, so that's like nothing. And so we, really felt inspired and excited that there was going to be this a series of installations from Latino artists that were going to be on campus. And the way that Revelaciones came to fruition, Joseph, was that the Herbert F. Johnson Museum of Art and the Hispanic American Studies Program, HASP, it's the a predecessor to the Latino Studies Program. So we didn't have a Latino Studies Program, but there was something much, much smaller called HASP. And so they had partnered together to bring together this exhibition. And their collaboration on this exhibition was going from November 6th of 1993 to December 19th of 1993. And it was called Revelaciones, Revelations, Hispanic Art of Evanescence. And so this was co-curated by Jose Piedra, who at the time headed up HASP, and John Noriega, who was a visiting professor at Cornell at the time. And it was a series of installations, as I had shared, and there were eight different Hispanic artists that had their work presented there. So it wasn't just this one installation that ended up in the Art Squad. It wasn't just Daniel J. Martinez's, but there were several. And so I believe they were Maria Brito, Mercardillo, Ronald Gonzalez, Gronk, Amalia Mesa Baines, Rafael Montoñez, Ortiz, Cecilia Alvarez Munoz, and then, of course, Daniel J. Martinez. So there, I mean, for us, it was kind of exciting. Like, all of a sudden our culture is going to be highlighted and shared with the Cornell community. And in fact, the premise of this exhibition was that they were invited to celebrate the breadth and depth of our culture, of the Latino, Latina art and culture. And so, it was. They were given the opportunity to be able to create art that spoke to their expression of identity. And again, this fell squarely in this idea of any person, any study, and here you go, we're now going to be represented. So, I was very proud and very excited that an artist of this stature, that artists, right, plural, these eight artists of this stature were going to be presenting their installations here at Cornell, or they were presenting their installations at Cornell, and we really, I mean, felt seen by this. It was something that was exciting. And then, specifically, if we talk about the artist Daniel J. Martinez, who was responsible for the installation on the Art Squad, "The Castle Is Burning," he was, or he is, an extraordinary Chicano artist from LA, who has received tremendous awards. I mean, he. I can, just share. I'll share. At the time, he already had a National Endowment from the Arts and NEA as an individual artist fellowship, and he had, I believe, already the NEA Project Support Grant. But I mean, he's gone on. If you look him up in Wikipedia, he's gone on to receive countless awards and opportunities, and I mean, he's just done so many things that, again, these weren't just, random artists that were picked out of nowhere to come and present. They were, extraordinary, powerful artists, amazing in their own right, and all assembled, these eight assembled to come to Cornell campus. And wow, how awesome, was that?
Definitely amazing artists, and it's really amazing that at that time there was that opportunity to really show that representation on campus for students. As folks were learning more about it and about the exhibits and enjoying it, how did things shift in terms of learning that the art installation by David Martinez was defaced, and how did the students talk about it?
Yeah, so it was such an extraordinary juxtaposition to what I just related, Joseph. On the one hand, there was this vision of bringing these artists to Cornell to be able to celebrate the breadth and depth of our culture, right? And so when it was going to be celebrated, the idea was for it to be celebrated with the Cornell community as a whole, with all of Cornell University. And that's why it was a partnership, right, between the Johnson Museum and HASP. And it went from that to seeing all of a sudden the heinous response to the structure that was on the Art Squad. And so Daniel J. Martinez, his creation on the Art Squad, I mean, it definitely was something. I think that for many people was unexpected. So it was this huge installation that crisscrossed the Art Squad. And so they were 8 feet tall, kind of, I guess I'd say, big pieces of board that were covered with tar, that blocked your view. And so it ran along the arts quad such that, you know, it was inevitable for you to come in contact with them. And so several people found this confrontational, and some people didn't like it. I shared with you a little bit about, you know, the caliber of the artists, because, you know, some people, despite the caliber how prominent the artists were, felt that this art was not to their liking, on the contrary. And so what ended up happening is people ended up putting graffiti on the panels, because they were these, as I said, these huge, big panels, 8 foot high. And I mean, it was egregious stuff, like, and I'm gonna, you know, these are, you know, I'm gonna quote things that people had written in the graffiti, things like, you know, Cesar Chavez is dead, with a smiley face underneath that. I'm gonna quote something else that someone had written. Someone actually wrote, "Kill the illegals." I can't even say that. I don't even know if I. And someone, you know, had written on it, "White pride." There were swastikas, and pieces of it had actually been kicked out. It's really interesting, because so you can get a sense of the thinking behind this piece. He actually, at the top of these big pieces of plywood, or, you know, that I had shared with you, that were covered with tar, he actually had quotes from Diogenes, the Greek philosopher, on the top of them, right? So on top of these 8 foot black walls, he had these styrofoam quotes that were taken from his installation at the 1993 Whitney Biennial. So this is art that he had been very much conceived and considered, and you know, it might not have been to the liking to some people, but to go from that to seeing these horrible things that I, Joseph, even saying it, I just didn't, so revolting. It was heartbreaking. It was incredibly confronting. I'm from upstate New York. I'm the daughter of immigrants. But when I think of upstate New York, I think, you know, this is the land of Frederick Douglass. You know, I think this is the land of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You know, I think of a much more progressive and inclusive vision of who we are as upstate New Yorkers. And so to be in upstate New York, right, 2 hours away from my home, and to see this, I was shocked and I was hurt, and definitely not reflective, right? This was not reflective of every person, every study. It was clear that, you know, some folks did not feel that our community was welcome. And you know, it felt like I wasn't welcome in my home state of New York. And so it was just, it was really, I said earlier, and I, you know, I think that is the word. It was really heartbreaking.
That was really tough and very difficult. It must have been really difficult as a student, really entering, seeing all of the vitriol that you saw from your fellow students. How did you take that kind of frustration, you and other students take that frustration and anger, and kind of turn it into a call for action?
Yeah. So, obviously, we as a community were talking about it. The Latino groups were all talking about it. It felt like an attack on our community. And that's really what led to the protest. I was one of many folks involved. Again, I was a baby freshman. And when the protest started out, there were about 100 of us. It was organized. So the umbrella group, La Asociación Latina, had you know, helped to put it together with other groups supporting it. And, you know, we came together at the installation. You know, the reason that we did that is because what I described to you, Joseph, is all the horrific things that had happened to it. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to describe to you what the university's response was. And that's why we decided to protest. It would have been one thing if this would have happened and, there had been strong condemnation of what had happened and the artwork had been protected. That would have been a reflection that this piece of art, which again was so inspiring to so many of us because we felt seen, was being taken care of. There was a place for it, there was a place for us. Instead of that happening, there was no response to it. The administration did not, condemn the things that were happening. And there's a very important, I think, additional data point that I want to share with you, and that is that there was another act of vandalism that happened around this period of time. So the statue of Ezra Cornell ended up also being vandalized with white paint being put on it. And when that happened, the administration did respond. And so it was just so clear the contrast. Okay, so this statue, right, this piece of art is vandalized and there is a response. This other piece of art that is representative of our community is vandalized and it's vandalized in this most egregious way, and there is no response. And so that's really what led us to say, we need to do something about this. We need to stand up and as a community protest the fact that this is happening. The other thing is if you go back to this period in time, in 1993, there had been a history of challenges that the community had been facing. And these challenges were not being addressed. And so it was kind of like it had gone to a tipping point. And this last thing that had happened was kind of the last thing that we could possibly tolerate. We could not tolerate it. And so that was what led to the student protest. The other thing that I do want to mention is Cornell has a really strong history of student protest and activism. And it's one of the things I love most about the university, besides some of the things that we've talked about throughout the course of our interview so far. I believe in inside outside activism. So I was involved with the Day Hall takeover, but I was also on the Cornell Board of Trustees. And I think that's one of the things that we need to remember is that students at Cornell have a history of being very much involved. And the Day Hall takeover, is not the first kind of student protest and student activism that has happened by communities that are affected and that are looking for change and trying to get the administration to engage with them. And so, the Willard Straight Hall takeover obviously is one that always comes to mind just because both of them are called takeovers. But there were so many others as well because of that history of student activism that Cornell has, which I think is, also student leadership. But so we started then with this protest. We came together on basically surrounding the installation. And at noon is when our peaceful protest started. And our hope was really to stand in solidarity as a community, protect the artwork, which was a symbol for so much more than just the art.
And from that protection of the art, how did that shift to going to Day Hall specifically?
So all of this was incredibly organic, Joseph. Again, we're these kids, right? I mean, like you're talking 17, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, right? And for a lot of us, this was just something that we felt in our hearts that we had to do. And we really cared and we wanted to make a difference. But we didn't have a particular strategy that, hey, we're going to head to Day Hall and Day Hall's the place that we got to go because X, Y, or Z. It was, we had been protesting at noon. And so the protest went on for a couple of hours because it started at noon. And according to the New York Times, it was around 2 p.m. when the Day Hall sit-in began. And so basically what happened is while we were on the Art Squad, there ended up being some incidents that happened even during the peaceful protest, believe it or not. People were coming from class, and we had some folks that were very antagonistic. Unfortunately, there, you know, I so I've been interviewing people for the book, and some folks have said that the way that folks interacted with them was not only not civil, but there were some tones of racism in the mix as well. Part of the reason, too, that we decided to do the protest that day on November 19th, 1993, was because there had been rumors that not only did the vandalism exist, and not only had they started the destruction of the installation, but there had been rumors that there were going to be students that were coming to actually destroy the whole installation. And so this was the energy that was happening at the time of this peaceful protest. I mean, it was a protest that was really beautiful insofar as the over 100 students that started the protest at noon were not only from our community, they weren't only Latino and Latina, but there were folks from other communities too. So you had folks from the African American community, you had folks from the Native American community, you had folks from the Asian community, you had people who were from the white community who were allies, you had folks that cared about this and were involved for other reasons as it relates to justice. And so you had that was happening, but then you also had these negative interactions that I just shared with you. And so, again, after having this protest for a couple hours, we decided to head to Day Hall because we wanted to talk with the administration. And we wanted the administration to say something, to say that this was not okay, to say that we did belong at Cornell, to say that the art belonged at Cornell, to say that, you know, we're included, that any person, any study includes the Latino or Latina community. And so that's why we went to Day Hall, because we knew that that's where the president was, that's where the main administrative building is for Cornell University. And so our hope was that if we went there, you know, we would get a positive response, and we would be told, you belong, right? This, you are included, Cornell. And any person, any study includes you. That's how we ended up marching from the protest to Day Hall. And by the time we got to Day Hall, the numbers had doubled. So it went from more than 100 students at the beginning of the protest to more than 200.
And how were you and the 200 other students received? And what were your demands when you got there?
When we got there, we had no demands. Out there, Joseph. We just wanted them to say, as I shared, super simple. I mean, what's happening, right, is not okay. Like, people should not be writing these atrocious things on this artwork. That's not acceptable at this university. You know, you guys do belong here, and the defacement of this art that has been created to honor your heritage, right, in this like a series of installations is not acceptable. And so that was really our hope. We didn't have demands per se until later when, you know, we were asked, what are your demands? You know, by I think it was even by the media. And we're like, okay, well, we need to put together some demands. And you know, I kind of joke because again, it wasn't that we went with these premeditated demands and said, okay, we need all these things. These are the things we're demanding. This is what we're asking for. However, at the same time that I tell you that all of this is organic, this was building on years of folks feeling that there were these tensions and that there were these challenges. And so it wasn't like this was coming out of nowhere. And so when, you know, folks were asked for their demands, they were able to put them together pretty quickly. But at that point in time, that first day when we first got there, again, it was very organic, and it was just to talk to folks in the administration. And the only reason that we ended up staying in Day Hall was because the meeting wasn't given. And then, so because the meeting wasn't given, that's what turned into a sit-in. And then after the sit-in had happened, we ended up being told at one point, okay, well, you guys are here. It's after hours. We're closing up and we're leaving. And we got locked in. So as you had said, Joseph, the takeover happened kind of by mistake. We weren't meaning to take over the building. What we were doing is we were protesting this horrible thing that had happened, this terrible vandalism. And again, we any person, any study, we were a part of that, and we wanted the administration to reaffirm that we were. And it was in not being able to get that meeting and being told you're here and we're leaving that we ended up in what I call basically it was a sit-in that lasted 4 days. We did actually end up coming with a list of demands because that is what was asked of us. And so I can share with you that, I actually want to read to you from La Lucha. We published it in the newspaper that we put together called La Lucha. La Lucha is the Spanish word. So in Spanish, you say La Lucha, it means the struggle. And it was a publication that we had that was student. Kind of run and published and written, and we did all of it. And so this is from the December issue, and it says the list of demands. The defacement of Daniel J. Martinez's artwork on the Cornell Arts Quad is reflective of a larger problem at Cornell. This problem is predicated on the absence of Latino faculty, administrators, and financial support for Latino students. As of 2 p.m., November 19th, 1993, we have been sitting in Day Hall and refuse to leave until we receive a guarantee from the administration that by November 23rd, 1993, a meeting will be arranged between the president, Frank H.T. Rhodes, Provost Nesheim, and a group of 9 to 10 Latino students chosen by the LAL steering committee to be held before December 3rd. Number one. That President Rhodes and the Provost immediately condemn the destruction of the artwork and instruct public safety officers to protect it. Number two, that President Rhodes acknowledge the problems of the Latino students on campus, specifically the decrease in overall financial aid and resources for Latino students. Number three, that a specific policy statement be issued with definitive deadlines as to how the recruitment, admissions, and retention of Latino students will be increased. Number four, that the university fully fund a coordinated schedule of activities within Latino Month that are free and open to the entire community. These activities should include speakers, films, and performances that will increase awareness about Latino culture, history, and related issues. Such activities should be planned in conjunction with LAL and all Latino organizations on campus. Number five, that the Cornell University Library System significantly increase the amount of money they allocate to the purchase of books, films, and periodicals about the culture and history of Latinos in America. Number six, that Cornell establish a special fund to bring visiting professors to the university in order to fill in the voids in regard to Latino faculty while they recruit tenure track professors. These faculty should be chosen in consultation with LAL and other Latino organizations on campus. And the honorarium of the speaker should be fully funded by Cornell University. Number seven, that the university immediately hire a Latino psychologist at Psychological Services and recruit additional Latino staff in all seven colleges. Number eight, that more Latino American history courses be offered. Number nine, that a Latino Living Center be opened by 94-95 school year. And then it says see proposal.
Thank you for sharing that and the track from the sit-in that turned into 4 days. How are those demands received by faculty and what happened as a result of it?
It was interesting because, as I had shared on day one, we end up locked in, and none of us had any plans to end up in Day Hall for the night. So, we don't have deodorant, we don't have a change of clothes, we don't have food. And so, that first night, it was for all of us, we were kind of perplexed, right, as to what the heck was going on. But we were here because we came because we believed that what had happened was wrong, and we wanted to stand in solidarity, and we did. And then these demands go out, and there really isn't a response. And so basically, what ended up happening is we are inside Day Hall as a community trying to communicate with the outside world. When I say we're communicating with the outside world, it's twofold. One, the outside world for those basic necessities, like I just shared, like food, clothes, deodorant. You have a bunch of 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds. We need those basic things. And so you had folks from the outside that were trying to help to support us with all of that. And because the doors were locked and there wasn't a way for us to be able to get things in through the door, people would, through the windows, share with us food. We actually, through the course of those 4 days, several of the different businesses in College Town and in Ithaca actually ended up donating food for us. There were rallies held outside, candlelight vigils that included prayers. And so that first day, that Saturday, there was actually, I can't remember which publication, if it was, I don't remember which of the publications, but they actually had published that there was a rally held that day at 3 p.m. and the candlelight vigil at 10 p.m. And it continued on throughout. It kept happening the other days as well. We were also communicating with, as I had shared with you, the external world, with media. And so we did end up at one point in time have CNN cover what was happening, the New York Times, and newspapers in LA and throughout the United States. As Friday turned into Saturday, and Saturday turned into Sunday, and Sunday turned into Monday, I mean, we're getting closer and closer to Thanksgiving, right? We started on the 19th, we go into the 20th, the 21st, the 22nd. And so one of our concerns was, okay, well, if the demands are not responded to, what are we going to do? Because right now we have all this incredible support. You have all these rallies that are being held. I mean, at one point on day three, on that Sunday, folks were singing gospel till 3 a.m. Outside of Day Hall. And so there was so much solidarity. But what happens when the campus closes because people are going away for Thanksgiving? And so one of the things that we were talking about when we were talking with folks at other campuses was some folks were thinking about coming and descending on Cornell to support us. And so specifically the Mexican American Student Association was in touch with other organizations, Mexican American Student Associations across the country. And there's this thing called pachanga that is done because many of the Mexican American students that are on the East Coast are coming from places that are much further away. So they're not necessarily going back to their homes for Thanksgiving. And so they get together at different places on the East Coast. And so the idea was, well, maybe everyone comes here to Cornell to support what's happening. And so that was kind of the deliberations. You asked specifically about the professors. So I'll share with you, and I want to give a shout out to an extraordinary human being who has played such an absolutely pivotal role at Cornell and also with student groups. And his name is Professor Hector Velez. And he actually, when all of this was happening, came in and really was trying to be supportive of, the students and what was going on. And through all of this, again, it all started very organically, but we ended up electing leaders, deciding, okay, who's going to be the leader? The head of LAL should obviously be, the leader. And then the different leaders from the different community groups, right? Campus groups also were leaders, and people were going around. The leaders had on like different bandanas around their arms, so we knew who they were. And so we kind of started organizing a community. But these professors, without their support, I don't know what would have happened. And not only during the takeover, but also afterwards, because we were threatened with, expulsion. Suspension and expulsion. And we did lose several people over the course of the takeover as a result. And people had to do whatever was right for them, but people left because of those threats. But at one point, we heard later when we were interviewing one of the professors that all of the Latino professors had said, if you do move forward with this, and if you end up, suspending and expelling these students, then we'll all walk. And so incredibly grateful for that heroic and committed action from the faculty, which by many people was never known about.
So what did you get from the demands at the end of it?
So I think, there has been progress at Cornell, and obviously there are some very concrete examples of this, right? Undeniably, the Latino Living Center exists, and it has existed over the course of all of these decades, and it has impacted the lives of not only the students who have lived there, but everyone who has in some way engaged with the building or the staff or the programming. So that's definitely, I think, a clear legacy. Sila, as was born afterwards, as we as alumni have come together to continue to support our community. And so that is in existence and continues in existence. One of the things that is not talked about as much, but that actually, so we're going to be doing an event in Ithaca on November 17th. It's the third of a series of events that we've been doing to commemorate the 30-year anniversary of the Day Hall takeover. And this event on November 17th in Ithaca, we're actually going to have a panel of people that are talking about all this history that I just shared and more, and also, the legacy. And one of the panelists, the reason that I asked her to participate is she has such an extraordinary story about the impact that the hires. So if you recall in the demands, one of the things that we had shared was one of the challenges is that we didn't have professors and that we needed them to come. And so there were two tenure track, there were two endowed professorships actually that came out of this. And she, her story as it relates to the impact, not only that it had on her, but her seeing and knowing all of the students that were impacted by these two professors is pretty extraordinary. And so that is a wonderful legacy. I think that there's definitely been more focus and understanding on lifting up these topics that are of import to our community. And I think that there's still a long way to go. Cornell is an extraordinary place, and I love it. My life will be forever intertwined with Cornell, and so I think wonderful things of it. And at the same time, it's like the rest of the world, a work in progress. And so, whereas there have hubieron muchos logros, right? There were many wins. La lucha continúa, right? There's still a lot of work that I know that students feel that needs to be done. So, when all of this ended, I, you know, something that was very important to me was that in November, on November 30th, I actually had the opportunity to testify in Albany. And I the reason that that happened was because Cornell is a private and a public institution. The SUNY Assembly was interested in hearing about what had happened. They wanted to know, right? This because Cornell is in part a public institution. And so I went with some other folks and I testified in Albany about what had happened. And as I was looking at my comments that I had written, as an 18-year-old, a lot of hyperbole in my commentary, but at the heart of it was, as a student, our desire to want to be seen and included and feel like Cornell was home for us too. And so, I think the students continue on that journey and continue advocating for themselves as well they should. But again, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that we had the opportunity to do what we did, and I'm grateful that the administration did respond as they did, President Rhodes did end up issuing a statement denouncing the vandalism on the Martinez piece after he met with student representatives. I'm going to read to you from two of his statements that are attributed to him. So the first is, and here I'm quoting, "It is essential that the entire campus community come to grips with the issues that have been identified." And then the second quote, "Contemporary works of art will often be controversial, as much in their interpretation as their style. But to deface them in this way betrays the nature of the university." And so my hope is that as we remember what happened at the Day Hall takeover and in the events leading up to the Day Hall takeover, we realize that this is a critical part of Cornell history and, you know, one that I hope we continue to build on, so that the contributions from our community are truly appreciated and accepted, and not even just accepted, but are celebrated very much as the intention of this exhibition was in this first place. And ironically enough, one last thing I'll leave you with, Joseph, is one of the beautiful things that was happening inside of the building — we didn't talk about what was happening inside of the building as much — is that there was that celebration. Inside, those of us that were in there, you know, the 100 of us who later turned to, you know, less than maybe like 70 or so at the end, we were learning, we were teaching each other things, you know, we were sharing about our culture, we were doing art, we were dancing, there was music. And so that celebration of our culture and that embracing of who we are in the world, I think was present there. And my hope is that it will continue to be embraced and integrated more and more at Cornell as the years go on.